All right, it is time for us to get started. We're going to be picking up where we left off last week. We'd started with James chapter 4, and it just started getting into some of the details of that. And many of you probably remember how we have been doing this class is when we come across a major section, we'll sometimes take a detour to go more in-depth on the subject matter and try to really get a good grasp of what exactly is being talked about, why it's being talked about. And so tonight we're going to be taking one of our slight detours in reference to the early part of this passage. And for those who remember, what was James talking about at the end of James chapter 3 that led us into chapter 4? What was the subject matter? What was that? It would start off with the tongue, and towards the end, it kind of had a slight detour in its subject matter and started talking about wisdom. And specifically, two different types of wisdom, worldly wisdom and also godly wisdom. And so what James is doing is he talks about these two ideas, he gives the contrast of these two ideas, and then immediately in chapter 4, he dives into the consequences of worldly wisdom. The consequences of worldly wisdom, those who are engaged in this, there's going to be some negative consequences that follow. As we understand, God gave all things to us, all things that are good, all things that are good for life and godliness. God has given those things to us. In James chapter 1, verse 17, every good and every perfect gift is from above and cometh down from the Father of lights, in whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. So we understand that God gives us good gifts. The characteristics He gave us are good, but mankind can corrupt those things. And when those good things are corrupted, then we have the negative consequences that follow. We understand this thought in many different instances. Is the idea of choice a good thing? Giving you a choice, is that a good thing? Yes. You go into a Wendy's and they tell you exactly what you want to eat, you're going to be pretty upset. Choice can be a good thing. However, we also can see some people who have taken the idea of choice to its extreme, where I get to choose who has a right to live and die. No. So we see that there can be consequences to a corruption of what God gave, and that's exactly what we're going to be looking at tonight. You see, wisdom of the world gives the appearance of wisdom, but we find out that it does not follow through. Very similar to how we talked about sin in chapter 1, how sin in of itself is a form of a gift. How is that? How do we discuss that sin can be a gift? It's something we enjoy. It might meet a temporary need, but how is it not a complete gift? Because we just said every good and every perfect or whole complete gift comes from God. How is it not a complete gift? You're going to pay consequences for those pleasures. God offers us peace everlasting. Sin can offer us temporary ease. So you see how it kind of works. It looks like what God would offer. It looks like a good thing, but it cannot follow through on the promises it makes. And so that's kind of what we're going to see happen here with this wisdom of the world versus the wisdom of God, is it's going to look like, okay, that makes sense. And in an everyday situation, we would look at it and say, okay, yeah, that makes sense. That follows through. But if we really look carefully and we look at the long-term consequences, we begin to see where the problem unfolds. So chapter 4 is specifically focusing on a major problem in the early church. And that problem was conflict. Conflict. Can conflict be a good thing?
Yeah, it can strengthen.
It can strengthen you, yes, absolutely. It can be good for the individual. Depending on the situation, it might even be good for a large group of people. I mean, if we go back and look throughout history, if we look at 1939 to 1945, was that conflict, World War II, was that a good conflict for the world in some ways?
In some ways, yes.
How is that? The United States boomed. We had prosperity like we've never had before. We were stopping an enemy who was bent on the destruction of many other races of people. That was something that should have been dealt with. It also dealt with the oppression of the individuals that were there and liberated them from their prison sentences or all these other things. So it was a good thing for overall the world. there were some negative consequences that came from it. Don't get me wrong there. But sometimes conflict is necessary. And so by it being necessary, it is a good thing. So when we look at this idea here, why would I call it Christian paralysis? Why would conflict be Christian paralysis? Just what's the first thought that comes to mind?
Freezes everything up.
It freezes everything up. Why, going back to our same analogy of World War II, why was America able to prosper but England and France were brought to their knees? Because America wasn't directly involved in the conflict, right? It wasn't directly being bombed on a daily basis. When we look at conflict in the church, the closest illustration we can give is that of a civil war. And what happens in a civil war? Does a nation thrive in the middle of a civil war? No. It grinds everything to a halt. I can't ship anything because there's a likelihood it'll get raided. I can't produce anything. The factory might be bombed. I can't have my people live here. They might get attacked. Everything grinds to a halt. And friends, the church is no different. See, the church is described as a kingdom, right? It's God's kingdom. We are His citizens. We are described as soldiers as well. All these things fit Christianity. So just like a nation can be brought to its knees by civil war, a church can be brought to its knees by civil war. And that's exactly what James is dealing with, are the consequences of this worldly wisdom that breeds about conflict. Now, when we look at the idea of conflict, most of us would say, I hate conflict. I don't want to engage in conflict. I'm not the personality that just wants to go fight somebody. Even people who do want to go fight people say, I don't want to fight anybody. That's just not a culturally accepted thing. Why would you want to go fight somebody? Why is that something you want to do? No, many of us would follow more into the lines of pacifism than aggression. We say, well, I would just rather avoid the thing altogether. It makes me uncomfortable. It makes me stressed. It causes problems. People might get hurt. I don't want to be involved. But the reality is, more conflicts are caused by inaction than action. More conflicts are caused by people not doing something than doing something. And you say, well, how does that make sense? Okay, if you have a person who is causing issues in a church and the elders don't deal with it immediately, is it better then to have that slight little confrontation there and deal with that issue then, or wait till they have 15, 20 people that are backing them and it becomes a whole big blown out problem? We can see how that works. More conflicts are caused by not stopping things. But when we're looking at this issue in particular, James is going to be dealing with the cause of conflicts primarily. This first section is all about the causes. Now, everyone's got a reason for why something happens. If you go have two people who fight each other in the streets, the police come up and they try to take a report, both people are going to have very different stories about what just happened. They're going to have my side, his side, and the truth. That's what's going to happen there. Because in the mind of the combatants, everything is the fault of the enemy. Everything is the fault of the person who just did me wrong. And even if you were directly responsible, you're still going to try to have blame for the other person. We even see that happen in Genesis chapter 3 when Adam and Eve sinned against God. What happened there? God comes to Adam and he says, did you take of the tree? And he says, well, that woman you gave me, it was her fault. Have you ever thought about what he just told God in that situation, just as a side note? He just said, this perfect gift that you gave me, the one that you looked on and said was very good, hey, that caused me to sin. God, my sin is your fault. Let's not miss that there. That's a pretty intense accusation to give against God, but they were passing the blame. See, Adam didn't want to have all that fall on him. He wanted to just shove it off onto somebody else. Then God goes to Eve. What does Eve say? Well, the serpent caused me to sin. The serpent's the one that led me astray. Conflicts can have many, many different issues that bring them about. But ultimately, a conflict starts when both sides are irreconcilable. A conflict starts when both sides are irreconcilable. What do I mean by that? What do you think that means?
They can't agree.
They can't sit down and agree on this. They can't make this work. Now, we've seen stuff like this happen before. We've seen many nations, even in our own day and age, who have dealt with this. If two nations are trying to come to an agreement on something, and they might be in deliberations for months and years on end, and finally it just comes to war. because they just can't come to an agreement that doesn't involve violence. But this is what we see happen many times, even in interpersonal conflicts. Between members of the church, between family members, between friends, all of these things are come because both sides can't agree. They can't just look at this situation objectively and make it work. Let's go ahead and look at Matthew chapter 5. That's Matthew chapter 5. We're going to start in verse 23 and go to 25. Here, Jesus is preaching in the Sermon on the Mount, and we're going to see his attitude towards conflicts and the attitude that a Christian should have toward this as well. If someone could read verses 23 through 25, please.
Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there remembering that thy brother hath ought against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First, be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thy adversary quickly while thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison.
All right, so what is the overall topic here? If you have a heading in your Bible, it might tell you what the section is. What is the issue that Jesus is addressing here? What was that? Personal relationship. Specifically, what characteristic, though? What emotion is he dealing with right here?
Anger.
Anger. He's dealing with anger. Specifically, he's dealing with the heart of a man that brings about these consequences. The conflict with your brother doesn't just immediately start, usually. Usually, even if we're friends with someone, really good friends with someone, even if they wronged you, it's going to take a little while for it to actually boil over into conflict. It might start out with, oh, you ran over my flower bed. Okay, well, we might get upset about that. We might say, okay, well, that needs to be paid for. But if we're good friends with the person and we actually like the person, the odds of us going out there with a shotgun and running them off of our lawn is not going to be likely. That's not usually how we jump to things. But now what happens if you've had conflict after conflict with this person? They've constantly messed with you or constantly messed with your things, and it just boils over. See, what Jesus is dealing with is the heart, primarily. And that's what the whole section really comes down to, is the heart of the individual. He says, you've heard that it hath been said, verse 21, to those of old, you shall not murder, but whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to hell fire. So he's saying, oh, if you're angry at all with this person, you're wrong? No, not exactly. We'll see in the King James Version, he says, who's angry with his brother without a cause. You see, Jesus was angry with people before. I mean, he flipped over the tables. He ran people out of the temple grounds. But he had justifiable anger. He had reasonable anger there. He's saying here, you are dealing with a heart that is harboring anger. You're allowing it to sit and to fester. You're allowing this to change your actions because he's saying, yes, it is wrong to murder. He says, but I'm trying to stop it before we get there. I'm trying to tell you, you need to fix this before we even get to this action. And so Jesus has the attitude of conflicts need to be stopped oftentimes before they're started. It's a lot easier to mediate and to try to, well, I say easier, it's simpler. It's simpler to mediate and work something out than to deal with a cleanup after a conflict. There have been churches all over this country and all over many other countries as well who just because of the attitude of one or two individuals, it caused the whole thing to fall apart. The whole thing to cause issues with one another. And many of those situations would have been just simple enough to have a conversation and say, hey, this is not the way we should be talking to each other. This is not the way, someone to take a step back and say, hey, this is going too far here. Are we not brethren? Are we not Christians? Are we not trying to follow after Christ? Let's make sure we have our mindset right before we try to solve a problem. Go ahead.
I've been It says, Matthew 5 and 8 says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. We want to have pure hearts.
Absolutely. For those who couldn't hear, Monty was describing how in verse 8 of chapter 5, we're to have those who are pure in heart shall see God. We should have that mindset and have that attitude of we're trying to purify our lives, trying to purify our hearts, because out of that come the issues of life. Go ahead.
This is not exactly what you're talking about, but I think it's worth mentioning here. In verse 21, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said by them of old, you shall not murder, but whoever murders is in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, some people have said that what Jesus is doing here is changing the law, and that's not what he's doing at all. He's saying, you've heard them teaching that as long as you don't follow through and murder, you're okay. And some people have taken that to mean that the old law was just about the outward, but the new law is about the heart. And that's never been true. The greatest commandment in the old law was to love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus is saying they haven't been teaching this right. They say as long as you don't murder, you're okay. As long as you don't commit adultery, you're okay. And Jesus is saying service to the Lord always begins in the heart. It's not okay to murder, but it's not okay to hate your brother. It's not okay to commit fornication, but it's not okay to lust in your heart. That was true in the Old Testament and the New Testament. So he is showing that true service to God, old or new, always started with your heart being right.
Absolutely. And just for summary's sake, if you didn't hear what Don was talking about, he was going back and saying that, he says, you've heard that it hath been said aforetime. Some people try to take it and say, well, see, Jesus is trying to change the old law. Well, Jesus even described what his mission was. His mission wasn't to destroy the law, but to fulfill it, to really show you what it actually meant. I heard a preacher on one occasion say that if you go from Genesis all the way to Revelation, what you watch is not just the unfolding of Jesus' story of him coming to earth and bringing about the church and all those things. He said you also watch the maturity of man. You watch how man goes from being a person who is being told directly what to do, but as it goes along, you see how God is revealing himself consistently throughout Scripture and showing in more detail what's taking place. The law was there as a guideline. I mean, even Paul said the law was there. I would not have known sin except for the law. I would have not known what it was. And we see how God presented himself to mankind. He presented himself as I'm the creator, first of all. I am God. Secondly, he presented the old law to show that what I say is important, that sin has consequences, and they are very severe. And then when the New Testament comes along, he says, this is the fulfillment of everything we talked about before. There's come salvation to all men. So you watch how this all progresses, and Jesus is really going into the heart of matter, like Don was saying, and he's saying, look, it's not just don't kill someone. It's not okay for you to get to the point where you're standing there with a gun and say, you know, I just don't really want to kill the guy today. He said, you shouldn't even be at that point. You need to start way before that. You need to check your own attitude about that person, first of all. The quickest way to harm someone else is to devalue them, to look down on them, to say they are lesser than me. It's easy to step on an ant. It's harder to kill a person. But if we reduce a person down to that level, which does not happen overnight, which is what Jesus is dealing with here, you have to change your own heart and how you view these people. You need to change your heart and how you view the situations here. So much so that he's even going so far as to say, if you have aught with your brother, if you have a problem with your brother, you need to hold off your own worship to me until your heart is right to where I can actually accept it. Remember what happened with Cain and Abel. Abel came to God and he gave him exactly what he was asked to do, correct? Yes. But his heart was also right. Cain decided he would give his own offering, what he chose to do, and God did not accept it. Remember what God told Cain after that? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do what I ask you to do, will you not be accepted? Friends, when we come to worship God, we are presenting ourselves before him. We are presenting ourselves as Christians before our God and giving worship or alms to him. What does he see when we come to worship? When the Jews came to worship, they had to offer the first of their flock. We have to offer our goods to God. When the Jews came to worship, they had to offer the best that they had, the unblemished, the unspotted. When we come to worship, we are offering a sacrifice as well. Romans 12, 1 and 2, what does it say? We're presenting our bodies, a living sacrifice to God. Our own lives are being presented to Him. What does He see when I come into worship? If I have anger harbored in my heart for my brother, if I have a conflict that I'm still hanging on to when I come into worship, am I presenting God a spotless lamb? Can God accept worship from someone who is living against Him? No. In fact, we know He won't accept that. We see that in Micah chapter 1, right? So as Christians, we are presenting ourselves before Him. And what Jesus is describing here is you need to make sure that your heart is right. You need to deal with this conflict before you even come to worship. Any comments or questions on that point before we move on? All right. So as we continue on with this thought here, Jesus is dealing with you, make sure your heart is right. You don't get to the point where you're irreconcilable. He goes to the next point. As Christians, we are to seek peace. That is to be our attitude. When it is possible, we are to seek peace. That's Romans 12, 18, right? What does it say there? As much as lies within you, let us live peaceably with all men. That is, as Christians, what we are to be doing. What did Jesus say again in Matthew chapter 5? Blessed are the peacemakers. It's not an accident that He put peacemakers. What's easier to do? Is it easier to have a conflict or peace?
It's easier to have peace.
Is it easier to have peace? Is it correct? Let me change that. Is it easier to maintain peace?
It's nothing. It's easier to have conflict because oftentimes you don't want to try to make peace because of the feelings or what you think the other guy's going to say or do.
It is much easier to engage in conflict than peace because peace requires sacrifice. Peace requires me to give up something oftentimes. If you go look at any peace agreement across the board that two nations have come in that were very close to conflict, what is the common denominator of all of those agreements? Someone had to do what?
Give up something.
They had to give up something. Usually both sides had to give up something. They had to say, okay, I will let you have this, but I also need this. That way we can both walk away from this and feel like we both won here. In fact, you go look at any counseling or any counselor or any marriage counselor or things of that nature, and you hear how they talk. Does a conflict in a marriage ever work if one side gets to be the winner and one side gets to be the loser? Mm-mm. No. You have to work together because you're supposed to be on the same team. That's what they'll constantly bring out. You're on the same team. You're on the same side. Yes, we have different opinions on how this should work out, but all at the end of the day, we're on the same team. As Christians, we are trying to bring people to the same team. We're saying, look, you're going to disagree with me about some things. That's obvious. I'm a person. I make mistakes. I don't always see things the way maybe I should. But when it comes down to it, a lot of the things we have conflicts over are not things that necessarily have a right or wrong answer to them. Most of what conflicts come from is personal opinions, personal feelings. And we have a whole chapter in the book of Romans that deals with personal opinions and personal feelings, Romans chapter 14. And we've all had some issues with that across the brotherhood of understanding what exactly that means, because we like to say that, well, because I believe it's a fact, or I believe that it's something that should be law, then it therefore is law and not just an opinion. But we have this attitude that comes up all the time. But peace requires sacrifice. It requires us to give up something. It requires us, more often than not, it requires us to give up the one thing that most people struggle with more than anything else, and that is our pride. It is very easy, even for humble people, to engage in pride. Because pride doesn't always show itself as the guy walking out with the best suit on and saying, I'm better than you. That's not always how pride presents itself. Pride can present itself in saying everything is about me and making me feel comfortable. Pride can present itself as, I don't like what that decision was, and so I'm going to cause a stink about it to everybody else. Pride presents itself in a lot of different ways, which is why we see the book of Proverbs, Solomon deals with it so many times. And the situations that he engages in doesn't always sound exactly the same either. And so as we're looking through these thoughts here and how James is approaching this early church, it would have been easy for them to engage in these conflicts, to have these problems that come about. What if I was to just come out here for a second, and we'll go ahead and try this as a quick little exercise. If I were to ask you what the greatest problem is in the church as a whole, what would it be? You can go ahead and say the first thing that comes to your head. Greatest problem in the church today?
Lack of study leads to lack of knowledge.
Lack of knowledge. I mean, we can see in the Old Testament, and believe it's in the book of Hosea, how God says, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. That's definitely a big one. What was
that? 6 and 4. You were quoting 6 and 4.
6 and 4? Thank you.
4 and 6.
4 and 6? 6 and 4? Okay. We got it. It's in the book of Hosea. Do what now?
Already got a conflict.
It worked out. We had a mediator. We got it. We got to the same team. We were on Hosea.
We did that for an example.
Example, exactly. Yeah. I'll give you your 20 afterwards for the illustration. But we can all come up with ideas as to what the biggest problem is. Sometimes we can say it's a lack of knowledge, but some people have really studied, but they don't actually understand. So it's not so much a lack of knowledge as a lack of wisdom. So we can all come up with different things that are the greatest problem to the church today. But what James was dealing with were things that supersede specific instances. See, if I can get conflict under control, will that not solve a lot of other issues? It usually will. One of the issues we've seen today, and a lot of professors and philosophers have talked about this in Western cultures, we've lost the ability to debate. We've lost the ability to come up and present two different ideas and try to come to an agreement, try to find out which one makes more sense. We've lost that ability because we haven't learned how to have conflict. It's a major thing that's come up because you'll watch those two debaters. The second one of them gets a zinger on the other, you just watch the face of one of those guys. It just changes completely. He might have been happy the whole debate, making jokes and acting like the most personable guy, but he just got his pride hurt, and you can see it. That's not what those are ever supposed to be. Debates are simply presenting your arguments in the most accurate or the most intelligent way possible and let the audience decide for themselves. But what have we done? We've turned it into, this is a battle on stage, and we're sitting here like Thursday Night Fight Club wanting to see who wins. Christianity's never supposed to be that way either. When someone becomes a Christian, true or false, they know everything there is to know about being a Christian. No. No. Many times you come out of the water and the first thought is, now what? Now what do I do? I know what I needed to do to be saved. Now what do I need to do going forward? With a lack of knowledge, does that mean there's going to come moments where a person falls short? Whether intentionally or unintentionally. Yes, it's going to happen. Christianity requires maturity. It requires growth. Now, where the problem comes is not just immediately the person making the mistake. The biggest problem comes with how do they respond when they're told they made a mistake. See, our knee-jerk responses a lot of times is you messed up, and what do we say? Well, you did. Well, you didn't. Wrong attitude. See, if we work together and we say, okay, you say I made a mistake, show me where I made my mistake. I want to know. It's not prove to me because I have to have the acceptance here in order for this to happen. No, it's saying, show me so I can make this right. I heard a quote a while back, and I don't remember who said it. But this guy said, the smartest guy in the room is the one who knows he's the dumbest. Makes a lot of sense. Because if I think I'm the smartest man in the room, what is the one thing I will never do from someone else?
Listen.
Listen. And there's another word that comes right after that, starts with an L. Learn. I will not listen. I will not learn. If I think I'm the smartest guy in the room, no one's going to be able to teach me anything. But if I say, I don't know everything, I'm willing to learn, I want to grow, then when I have someone present me with your life is not right, then we can have a discussion and not a conflict. So this is kind of what we're dealing with here in this first century church, is these people are having all these different conflicts that are coming up, and James is saying, hey, this shouldn't be happening. Where is this coming from? See, the wisdom that is from men seeks out the easy path, which often leads to conflict. We just talked about it a second ago, how conflict comes usually because we want to give up, we want to take the easy road. It's easier for me to yell at you than to talk to you. It's easier for me to shut you down than to have an intelligent discussion. And this is not something that's new. It's not something that has just magically popped up in 21st century America. This is something that's been done for years and years on end, silencing dissenters to make sure no one else can make a decision, so they have to listen to me. Let's go look at Proverbs chapter 28, because we don't have a whole lot of time left, but let's go look at Proverbs chapter 28. And if someone could read verses 4 and 5, whoever gets there first.
Those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but such as keep the law contend with them. Evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand all.
What is Solomon trying to get across here with this passage? What does it sound like he's trying to say here? Is he saying there are times when conflict is going to come up? Did he say that's going to happen here? What does the word contend mean? To wrestle with, to fight, to stand against. He says the righteous, those who are going to praise the law, those who do not forsake the law, they're going to strive against those who forsake it, who give it up. And he says, evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand it completely. We see today how someone might commit a crime, they're let off, and you got one group of people who are screaming to the top of their lungs how excited they are. You got another group of people who are saying this country's falling apart because we can't prosecute somebody. The absence of law is anarchy, which says, I get to do whatever I want. Well, we see in the book of Judges what happens when every man does that which is right in his own eyes. It causes a whole lot of problems for an entire nation. Those who are wise, those who understand that actions have consequences, they're going to understand that when this person faces difficulty because of what they chose to do, that's justice. That's their just deserts. A fool says, I can do whatever I want, and I should not have any consequences. Nothing bad should ever happen to me because, you know what, I'm doing everything the way I think it should be done, so nothing should go bad. There was one time that I was trying to cook, and I know some people are probably looking there and say, well, Josh cooks? He's 23 years old. He doesn't know how to cook. But I was trying to make a meal that my parents had taught me how to make, and I thought for sure that I had the right recipe. I thought for sure I was doing the right thing. And I can tell you this, when you're trying to cook a hamburger and you make it too big, it can cause your spatula to mess up. It doesn't always lift the way it's supposed to. And so it fell off, landed in a bat of grease, and I now have a hole in my foot. So, actions have consequences. Things happen as a result of what we do. A foolish decision caused that problem. So as Christians, we should understand when it comes to conflict that we have to, first of all, try to find out the basis of it. Let's try to deal with the cause of conflict before we're able to fix the rest of it. And we'll pick up there next week and try to go into more detail, but thank you so much for your attention.